Hello, everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. New issues up, and got a great conversation I had with Terry Persun, talking about creativity, meditation, and working with Amazon. We also are rerunning an interview we did with Andy Weir, who wrote The Martian, in which we interviewed him just as he was releasing it, before it had been optioned as a movie. And movie's out now, and it's a great conversation. How that book got published is really amazing. So check it out if you haven't heard it yet. That's a conversation that Jeff Ayers had with Andy Weir. So you can find that at authormagazine.org, and then we're funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from Penda Publications since 1955. If you want to learn more about the PNWA, and it's a great organization, you can go to pnwa.org. That's pnwa.org. So all you writers, all you storytellers, as you know, there would be no stories without suffering. If your characters, whom you love, if you just love these people to death, and yet you put them through such terrible circumstances, deprivation, loss, killers, lovers who won't respond, poverty, you name it. Without suffering, we'd have no story. Without conflict, we'd have no story. But we often don't want these kinds of experiences in our lives. We would love to skate through without it, but that's not how life works, is it? We do encounter it ourselves. And so today's guest, the wonderful Michaela Haas, PhD, has written a book about this very subject. Bouncing forward, transforming bad breaks into breakthroughs. How do we take these unwanted events, sometimes extremely unwanted, sometimes sort of catastrophically unwanted, and how do we take these events and turn them into something that can actually help us and help us grow and help us change? Why do some people grow from these events, from these seeming bad breaks, and some people not? It's a good question. Michaela Haas has actually been asking questions and good questions for a long time. She's a reporter, lecturer, and consultant, and she's the owner of Haas Live, an international coaching company for media mindfulness and communication training. And since the age of 16, no less, she has been working as a writer and interviewer for major nationwide German newspapers, magazines, and TV stations, including hosting her own successful nationwide talk show in America. Her articles have appeared in the Washington Post, the Huffington Post, and numerous online media. Oh, Michaela, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you on, and I think it's a great book you've written, and I'm really glad you're going after this subject, but I know it's not really chance that brought you to it. This book grew out of some experiences you had in your own life some time back. Is that not so?
That's true. And I don't buy into the myth that we have to experience suffering to become great artists or writers. So some of my favorite writers, certainly, you know, that's where the truth is. That's certainly where they found the motivation to write. But for me, bouncing forward, you know, sometimes we write what we need to learn. And for me, bouncing forward was that, because I got quite ill when I was in my 20s. So in your 20s, that's the age when you're supposed to be on top of the world and be energetic and go after your career. And all of a sudden, I got ill, and I was pretty much bedridden for 8 months. And I did not take it well, and I was not resilient. And I had thought of myself as resilient before, because I was traveling the world by myself and doing all these exciting things, live talk shows and news reporting and all that adrenaline-filled stuff. But when the pudding hit the fan, I fell apart. And so I wondered, you know, in my career as a reporter, I've talked to so many people who've been through things much worse than what I experienced. And I noticed these big differences, how some people fall apart and how others come out of these events stronger and wiser and more compassionate? So that was my question. What makes the difference? And can I learn to become more resilient? And I think I found answers, because I am convinced that we can learn to become more resilient. And meeting the people that I interviewed for Bouncing Forward, like Maya Angelou or Temple Grandin and others, I did learn from them strategies and methods not to give up and to look forward and what to do when the sky is falling.
Yeah. And so the 20-something-year-old Michaela, who got very ill, and I mean, and you describe it in your book, and you got really, really ill. This wasn't just a bad cold you had. This was quite severe. And,
well, I was studying in India and Nepal at the time, and no, but to this day, nobody really knows what exactly I got there. It must have been a virus combined with a few other things. So that was part of the scary thing, that doctors wouldn't find anything. So it took, that's why it took so long to get out of it, because at first they didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to help me.
Yeah, no one knew how to help you. And it sounds like to some degree, at that time initially, kind of you didn't know how to help you either, that mentally, although your life has been one that's sort of taken you on a spiritual path, whether it's mindfulness or Buddhism or writing this book, but at that time, even though you had sort of started on the spiritual path, it sounded like you didn't have this sort of internal know what to do with your attention at that time to sort of to balance yourself. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, I was in Asia to study Buddhism, and my PhD is actually in Buddhist studies. And so one of the things that really fascinated me was living with Tibetan refugees who had lost everything, their homeland, their families. Some of them had spent years or decades in prison camps, had been tortured, and they were among the most content and compassionate people I'd ever met. So there's a lot of wisdom in the Buddhist teachings, and I was a newly minted Buddhist at the time. I had started to practice meditation, but I call it good weather meditation. It wasn't holding up when I was down. And in Buddhism, they have all these great, you know, pieces of wisdom, like take adversity as the path, or the Dalai Lama says, your enemy is your best teaching. But I couldn't live that. I was like, yeah, you Buddhist wisecrack, sure, that doesn't help me right now. So it took me years to go deeper with that and to understand that actually this approach of not resenting the so-called bad stuff that's happening to us, that is actually very helpful, because so often when something happens, the Buddha called it the first arrow that actually injures us, and then we put a second arrow into the wound and churn it, and that's the despair and the anger and all that stuff that we heap on top of it. So I was doing that. I was churning the second arrow, and in the years to come, I learned that I did not have to do that, because it took a while for me to get better physically. So I realized that really what I had to work with was my inner resilience, my inner strength.
Absolutely. And so I'm going to just take a slight moment to talk to my listeners, many of whom are writers, and perhaps you will never go through the kind of physical discomfort that, or discomfort, but the kind of physical suffering that Michaela did. But if you're writing, you probably have to deal with quality of rejection and uncertainty, and it's extremely common. And so I have found the kind of techniques that Michaela is talking about now and talks about in her book extremely useful, as I have dealt with just the life of the writer, where there's so much uncertainty and rejection and fear of failure. And I'll tell you, I have ground so many second arrows, Michaela, into the wounds that I have received from when things didn't turn out the way I wanted to. And so can you talk about one of the first times sort of it hit you that you understood you were making the situation worse? You actually found yourself doing it and stopped. You know what I mean?
Well, not that easy. It wasn't
that
fast. No,
I know, but at some point you must have.
Yes, it was a process. I would say it took me about 2 years to slowly crawl out of that abyss and to find ways of working with my mind that were a little bit more helpful. Meditation, I've now been practicing meditation for over 20 years, and I believe, well, it's not just what I believe, it's so helpful, really, for physical pain and emotional pain, because it teaches us to stay present no matter what, stay present with what is. And I always say meditation is the easiest thing in the world, because all you need to do is sit down and focus on your breathing. And it's the hardest, because stuff comes up, and we need to learn to deal with that. And so it's not that, I mean, in a way, it's not that different from writing, like when you're in the zone writing.
No, it's not at all. I do both. Yeah, not at all. Not at all different. It's true.
Right? You're fully present, and then all kinds of stuff comes up.
Yep.
And you're even surprised at all the things that emerge. But also specifically as writers, you know, a lot of psychologists recommend writing the script of your life. And especially for many of the trauma survivors I spoke with, rewriting the script of their lives, or as Tedeschi, the psychologist who coined the term post-traumatic growth, calls it, integrating what happened into our life's narrative. That's extremely important. And I think as writers, we have an advantage because we can, I mean, especially if we write about our own lives, we can shape things, we can process things by writing about it, don't we?
Oh, well, I now write about my life to the exclusion of all other subjects. And I have found that it's extremely helpful. And I can't write about a subject. For instance, I can't write about something that happened in my life, and I only choose things that were interesting or challenging or frightening at the time, or I had epiphanies. But I can't write about them until I am no longer a victim in whatever situation happened.
Yes.
It is not a compelling story. And I often begin as feeling kind of like a mild victim, like someone did something or said something, or life did something to me. But the only way that is for that I can tell the story in a way that's useful to other people is if I'm not a victim anymore. And that takes usually a few drafts in some cases, maybe like a dozen.
Yes, well, the first draft is usually not to be shown to anybody. But also I think that's how we connect with people. I mean, that's really my purpose of writing Bouncing Forward is, of course, to learn about post-traumatic growth myself, but also to introduce my readers to the people I've met. And that's, I think, like Maya Angelou is in my book, and, you know, she had a very violent upbringing in childhood.
Yeah.
She was mute for 5 years after she was raped at eight years old. And for 5 years, she didn't speak, but she found refuge in books. She became an avid reader, and she read pretty much every book in the library in Stamps where she grew up. And that's where she found kinship and healing. And then that's what she did with her own books, writing I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings was so revolutionary and so helpful to many trauma survivors, especially of sexual abuse.
You know what I find interesting about her is that I adored Maya Angelou, and particularly I'm a kind of a fan of the spoken, of the voice, of the physical voice. And she had a gorgeous voice. And I can't help but feel in some way it was connected to being silent in some way. I think of James Earl Jones, too, who was a terrible stutterer as a boy. And I think she had one of the best reading voices I'd ever heard. And yet she was silent at that profound time in her life. I just feel that somehow these two things are connected.
I have a suspicion that might be true, because it was one of the elders in her community in Stamps that told her, you know what, you can't really love poetry if you don't read it aloud. You have to read it aloud. And that's what broke the silence for her. And I do think that in these 5 years where she didn't speak, there was a force that ripened in her. Definitely a power of language. And yes, it was amazing to speak to her and to hear that powerful, raspy voice that she had.
Well, so got to meet a lot of people, Michaela, and talk about this really beautiful subject. How can you think about the difference between Michaela before she started this book and Michaela afterwards? How has it changed you just researching it and talking to all these people and hearing story after story?
Well, I learned a lot of what helps people. That's really the question that interests me the most. What makes you stronger? And rather than focusing on all the things that get thrown in our life's path, I want to know what makes you stronger, what helps you. And that's what I learned from the survivors and from the interview partners in the book. And one thing I really take away from that is never to give up. Like now right. when I feel down, Maya Angelou or Jesse Billow, a paralyzed surfer, or Cindy Lamb, who lost her daughter, or Brigadier General Rhonda Cornham, who was captured in Iraq, they've gone mm-hmm. through things I don't think I could survive. And they did. And one of my friends who's in the book, cancer survivor Alain Beauregard, he said the sentence, he said, "Let go, but don't give up." And that right. stays with me because he had to let go of his life, of all his expectations for a while. He was just, you know, he's going through very harsh chemo and he really couldn't do anything about his situation. But he could, and he found a way to really turn his story around. So let go, but don't give up. I think that's so profound. And to take this away from all these stories of what people have done that helped them through the rough patches, that was really yeah. rewarding.
Let go, but don't give up. And that's so hard. There is such a fine balance. And I think it's very hard for people to understand the difference because sometimes our desire to resist what is happening, when what is happening yeah. is not something we would choose, feels like giving up. In other words, yeah. unless I keep fighting against my cancer or fighting against what is happening, I've given up. But it sounds like what your friend was saying, and of course what meditation is all about, is no, first you must accept what is, because it is what is. And if you fight against what is, you're fighting against essentially all of life, even if yeah. life is not what you want it to be. Does that make sense to
That
you?
Makes total sense. I think this acceptance, you know, the prayer we all know, grant me the serenity to accept the things I can't change.
Right.
That's so profound and so easy to say. But
yeah.
the people I spoke with for Bouncing Forward, they were really able to do that. Like Jesse Billar, the paralyzed surfer, he was 17 years old when he had that surf accident. And yet he was able to do just that. He said, okay, I can't walk. I will never walk again. But you know what? I can surf. So I'm going to go back into the ocean. And he now surfs some of the most dangerous waves
yeah.
in the world, on Fiji and other places. He goes diving with sharks. So focusing on what we can do and focusing on the things that are available to us and having the courage to change the things that we can change and, you know, hopefully the wisdom to know the difference is going to come eventually.
Yeah.
that's really a big takeaway.
Oh, it's huge. Well, I think it's in a way, I think it's understanding what life actually is. The difference between thinking you can control everything or control all your environment, which we can't, and learning to grow from the garden you're actually planted in, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Because all these things, they're so, you know, so easily said. And then in researching this book and sharing the stories to see people who actually live it, and it wasn't easy. I'm not glossing over the struggles because so often with these hero stories, you know, they fall down and then they get up and then they're the hero immediately. So
yeah.
I'm taking the reader on a journey here because I think the downfall is important in that learning process. And post-traumatic growth doesn't mean that everything is fine or that we're not hurting or that we're not wounded. It just means that we take the struggle as a learning process, and the growth actually comes out of that struggle.
But you must have chosen not to give up. There's some, I mean, you've had expansion in your life that has come about because you've chosen not to give up. Can you think of times when you thought, I've reached the limit. This is absolutely the limit. And no, I should not be expected. And yet you move through it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you can't move your body, it's scary. And I mean, I almost couldn't believe it. Like, really? I mean, I can't get up. I can't get out of bed. Are you serious, life? I mean, that's so unfair. Like, what are you doing to me? And there were certainly times when I felt like giving up. And then,
yeah.
you know, all kinds. It wasn't just the illness. And I found out my husband at the time was cheating on me, and he wasn't there for me.
Oh,
so
great.
The people that were closest to me weren't actually able to. I wasn't able to deal with it well, and they weren't
right.
either. They couldn't fathom that this young, vibrant woman who had just been traveling the world a few months earlier now suddenly was bedridden. Nobody could really fathom that. And so, you know, it was one thing led to another that made things more difficult. So that's why it took a while. And, you know, like many people, when I there was a while when I drank too much. I'm not ashamed to say that, because that's what a lot of us do, especially writers.
Yeah.
And of course, that numbs the pain, or, you know, takes the edge off temporarily. But ultimately, it's so unhelpful because you're not facing what needs to be faced. But I did that too for a while. So that also was part of the process, you know, to be able to face it and deal with it. And to, I just had to adjust that the recovery was very, very slow. It just wasn't going faster. And no matter how much I wanted it to, or how much I tried to will it, it just, you know, it just had its own time, and I had to give it that time.
You strike me as someone who from an early age was very ambitious. Would that be a fair description?
Yes, totally. And that's often, you know, chronic fatigue often strikes the overachievers. Like,
I don't know if you know
Pema Chodron, who wrote When Things Fall Apart. So she said that to me once, because she has chronic fatigue. And we actually spent some time together in Colorado, and I was asking her for advice on how to deal with this, you know, chronic situation of just not having a lot of energy. And she said, you know, it always hits the overachievers. But she said, at least it flattens the ego. And it does. It certainly does.
Oh, that's so cool. Well, we have a question, a live caller here who would like to ask you a question. So let's get him on here. And Jeffrey, is that you I see on the line?
It is I, Bill. Another fascinating interview. And this one is very near and dear to me as well, having not sharing with the world that I have a chronic autoimmune disease that I have to deal with daily.
Uh-huh.
My question is, and this has been essential for me, how important does she feel it is to have people close to you who are just there unconditionally? Not necessarily to write with or to complain to or just kind of share your misery, but just make you feel like you're normal and everything's okay and you've got great friends and great support.
I'm going to leave you on the line while she does the answer to this, okay, Jeff?
Thanks, Bill.
Well, thanks so much for bringing this up, because I think this is the most important factor of all, because I've learned that nobody can do it alone. No matter what happens to you, the most important thing is that we have at least one good friend. And that was part of why I found my situation so difficult, because, as I just said, the people I thought who would be there for me were not. And, you know, I tried to reach out and I tried to find help, and I couldn't. And that's what made it more difficult. But that's also something that I've learned from the people I interviewed for Bouncing Forward. It happened to several of them that, you know, Cindy Lamb got left by her husband when their daughter was paralyzed and she was a single mother. It happened to many of them that they were left alone after this terrible thing happened to them. And again, they did not give up. They kept reaching out. And so eventually, after many years, you know, I fell in love again, and now I have a wonderful relationship with a partner who's very supportive and who's able to deal with my chronic illness. So even if this magical support isn't there the second when it happens, I think that's so crucial that we keep reaching out and that we're also a good friend to others who are going through tough times, because sometimes it's uncomfortable what people have to say and share when they're down or when they're going through illness or loss. And to be there for them, to be a true friend, that's something I really, really value.
That's wonderful. Yeah, and I found that to be
and
so
Jeffrey,
important for me. Yes, Bill.
I was going to say, you've been like an incredibly supportive person, and you're one of the most supportive people I've met in the last few years through this work I do. And I hope that you have people who surround you who are as kind to you as I know you are kind to so many.
I do, Bill, and you are absolutely one of them. And as a matter of fact, she emboldened me enough to actually share that publicly for the first time. No one really knows.
Oh, great.
So,
wow,
yes,
that's
Bill, you've
awesome.
Been essential in my circle, and it's been money. You're right. And she's so correct that when you empower others, you not necessarily forget what you're challenged by, but you feel emboldened, you feel courageous, and you feel stronger. Wonderful. Yeah, very important interview, awesome. Bill. And thank you so much for taking my question.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks, Jeff. Yeah. So, you know, a lot of this book deals with the nature of pain and what it is. And
yes,
I know for myself,
emotional and physical, yes.
Emotional and physical. And what I have learned in the second half of my life is to, when I can remember to, is to look upon pain as information.
Yeah.
Only if I can do that. But that is not our normal relationship to pain. And maybe I don't know if you look at it that way, but I know that you have an evolved ideas about what pain is and isn't. Maybe you can talk a bit about that.
I don't think we realize how subjective pain is. There might be an objective part of the pain, but, you know, doctors talk about the pain landscape, and the pain is really made up of so many factors, physical and emotional and mental. And I have a chapter in my book, in chapter 6, I met a woman who is unable to feel any physical pain. And I included her because so many people say, pain, I don't want to feel any pain.
Yeah.
And, you know, in America, we're the world champions in taking painkillers, right?
Yeah, I know.
We take more painkillers than anybody. So I included this encounter with Maggie because I wanted to show what it's like not to have pain in your life. And it's difficult. It's not only difficult, it's life-threatening because we need pain as a guide. Pain screams at us because it asks for our attention.
Yeah, it really does. And we think we don't want it, but I mean, just think if you try the burn, if you put one of the metaphors I use with my students is when they're trying to avoid pain, I say, look, if you touch your hand touches the burner, you don't want to put your hand on the burner, but it's telling you not to touch the burner. It's telling you that. And the same pain when we think I suck or I can't do it or I'm not good enough or I'm not lovable, the pain we feel when we think those thoughts are information, too, about how untrue those thoughts are, how against them, ourselves they are. Do you know what I mean?
I think pain is a guide and a teacher. And learning to listen to it is really the path and part of the journey. And I have this great quote by Thomas Merton in the book who said, indeed, the truth that many people never understand until it is too late is that the more you try to avoid suffering, the more you suffer. And he says the one
Absolutely.
Who did most to avoid suffering is, in the end, the one who suffers the most.
Yeah.
So there is no way, because suffering happens anyway, so we need to learn to face it well and to use it for more compassion and kindness in the world rather than turning against ourselves, blaming ourselves or others, becoming angrier and more bitter. So that's really where I think the work lies. It's as just human beings and as writers, both.
As writers, too. And when you write, do you go through some of the typical writerly discomfort of thinking, who's going to want to read this? Why am I wasting my time? I mean, I know that this is work you're very connected to, but it's a very common experience a lot of writers go through. Do you go through that or have you moved beyond that?
Self-doubts? Oh, no, never.
Yes. Not even you, Michaela. Okay.
Of course. It's the writer's daily bread, right?
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. It's very common. In fact, I will tell you, part of the reason I do this work is just to have all those people out there who are maybe starting their first book to hear people like yourself say, yes, I live with self-doubt. Because I think some of the worst thing you can do is think I'm the only one going through it. If I were a better writer, I wouldn't feel this.
Yeah, that's what I love about writing, because we get to connect with other people and you find out that there are hundreds and thousands and probably millions of people in the world who feel what you're feeling. Because I think, you know, in our ability to cry and to grow, we're not that different.
No. In fact, Maya Angelou is the one who's Maya Angelou who said, there's far more about us that is similar than that is different. There's
exactly.
far more about us that is connected than that is different. And I think the closer you get to your soul, to your heart, the more. And this is interesting, Michaela. If I really want to connect with other people, I find the thing that most connects me to myself. And that's always the place where I connect to others, the thing that is so uniquely true to me. And that's the thing that reaches out to others.
Yes, you have to write.
As you've done with this book here. Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. Because, yes, Because I do think, as writers, it's the same question about how do we deal with pain? You know, can we find a way of putting it in words that might be helpful for other people, that might be inspiring for other people, rather than pulling them down? And this is certainly
what
I try to do with Bouncing Forward. So I'm not glossing over the difficult parts and the pain, but I try to keep the focus on what makes us stronger. And I try to, you know, shine a light in the tunnel is what I'm trying to do.
Yes, and you've done that. Congratulations, you have done that, in
Thank
my
you.
Opinion.
Thank you.
All right, well, listen. We've run over time just a little bit, but I feel I must ask you this question. I ask all my authors, and I definitely want to ask you as well. So what I'd like you to do is finish this sentence for me, and it is this. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what?
Well, that's a big one. It has taught me to not to be afraid to be honest, to speak and write from the heart. I think honesty is the quality I value most in writing.
Yeah, that is excellent. Excellent. You get an A for that answer, Michaela.
Cool. Thank you. Well, this is our friend Jeff was saying. He never shared the story publicly, and I can totally relate to that because I didn't share that I had a chronic illness for a long time because I was afraid how my colleagues would react, would I get less jobs. And to have that courage to step up and share your personal story, that's commendable.
It is.
And that's the first step to healing.
It is. It actually is. I found it to be the case for my life as well. And, well, Michaela, you're awesome. Thank you so much for being on the show. Good luck with the book, and I hope you get to reach lots and lots of people with it.
I hope so, too. And thanks so much for having me. I really appreciated your questions. Great questions.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks a lot, Michaela.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yes, people, don't be afraid of telling the truth. Oh, you know what? I will tell you, I didn't get to say this to Michaela, but I have learned for me that I'm a guy with big thoughts and big emotions and big feelings, and that all I ever need to do is just tell the truth, that the truth is always enough. I remind myself of that every time I sit down to write. Well, I'll be back next week talking to Michael Golding, novelist Michael Golding. Until then, go tell the truth. Can't hurt.